We'd like to thank our friends at PwC for their support, partnership, and collaboration in making Retail Gets Real. Learn more about how PwC helps retailers at pwc.com.
And that's the amazing thing we're going to see from the best retailers going forward, which are or will be the ones that at a physical level can bend the world and have it be a lot of shopping and buying. And then which are the ones in the online channel can create a better shopping, not just buying experience.
Welcome to Retail Gets Real, where we talk with retail's most fascinating leaders about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. The National Retail Federation's flagship event is going virtual this year at NRF 2021 Retail's Big Show Chapter 1. Innovative brands, big and small, will come together virtually to celebrate the best in retail and move forward with focus. Mitch Joel is an expert in reimagining what's next. And this January at NRF 2021, he'll be discussing the growth of e-commerce and what lies ahead for the fully digitized consumer. Mitch is an entrepreneur, author, digital expert, and founder of Six Pixels Group, an advisory, investing, and content company focused on brands and commerce. He's been named one of the top 100 online marketers in the world and was awarded the highly prestigious Canada's Top 40 Under 40 Award. He joins the Retail Gets Real podcast to share a glimpse into his Big Show session and talk how retailers are rethinking many commonly held beliefs about what works in commerce today. Mitch, welcome to Retail Gets Real.
Thank you so much. Where's applause for me, Bill Artemis? You shouldn't have.
Well, you know, you're always bringing down the house, Mitch. Whether you're in the house or out of the house, you're bringing it down. That's great.
I know people are hearing this, but I'm happy to hear your voices and see both of you for sure.
Well, it's great to have you. And we are being joined today by my friend, my colleague, and my co-host, Artemis Berry. Hello, Artemis.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to Mitch today.
How are you doing?
Doing really well. It's a quiet house. My kids aren't screaming, so it is a win for the day.
I know that.
Well, Mitch, tell us the Mitch story. I mean, where did you get your start? How did you get to where you are today?
It's in my second book, Control Alt Delete, I talk about how the most interesting lives are a squiggly life. It doesn't go from lower left after you graduate a college, university to top right. So it's a varied path, but I'll lay it out in reference to retail, which is my father was a retailer, and I am my father's son. He was a pharmacist, and he owned a pharmacy. Where I live in Montreal, Quebec, in order to own a pharmacy, you have to actually be a pharmacist. And so I would spend my weekends on Sunday. And again, if you know Montreal, it's a fairly religious city, lots of churches, and we didn't have Sunday shopping until, I wouldn't say recently, but fairly recently in terms of the world. You know, it's been decades, but it took a while to get here. And on Sundays, because pharmacies are basically like essential services, we would go around to different pharmacies. And I thought my dad was the coolest. Like, he knew all these pharmacists and all these people who worked in the store. And what I realized years and years later is that he didn't really know half of these people. He was scoping out the competition. He was looking to see where and how he should merchandise. He was checking out what products were happening in front of the dispensary. My mother would run the beauty counter, and that also meant around holiday season, things like chocolates and gift packages and stuff like that. And I just always loved being in the store, being in the basement with the boxes and seeing all of the displays. And I've carried that through, you know, my whole life. I still can't walk by a CVS or Walgreens without walking in. It's my wife calls it inventory control. It's like, I'm going to see what they have from store to store. I'm like that with bookstores as well, pen shops, comic book stores. We could go through the litany of weird habits and hobbies that I have.
Not going on vacation with you, Mitch, I promise.
Yeah, if you don't like to just even, I don't like to buy, I like to shop. And so in the early 80s, I became a music journalist. One of my first jobs was interviewing Tommy Lee from Motley Crue. I wound up publishing music magazines in the early days of the web at the same time, so around the early 90s. To frame it, I had a cover story on the net in 1992, and the big innovation at the time was hyperlinks, that you could go from one page to another by clicking on a highlighted word. Before that, you had to actually type the full URL and know the page in the actual address bar. So I did that for a bit. I wound up editing a newspaper for a local community that was featuring entrepreneurs. And one of those entrepreneurs was launching at the time a meta search engine. So we might remember before Google, there were things like Lycos and AltaVista and Dogpile and Yahoo and AOL. And the promise of the search engine was to deliver the ultimate search result. And I helped them build out their sales channel, which, you know, if we fast forward to 2020, 2021, it is the model by which we've seen multi-billion dollar valuations in places like Google and Facebook and YouTube and beyond. Short stint in a mobile content technology company that was long before we even had a mobile web browser, if I'm framing myself, but long before smartphones and things like that. And then in around 2000, I helped launch a digital marketing agency called Twist Image. And in that time frame, I started blogging and podcasting, which is called Six Pixels of Separation, and goes on to this very day. We built the agency to become one of the largest independent agencies in North America. And then continuing on with writing a couple books, doing a lot of public speaking, which is how I was introduced to the NRF going back, you know, 15, 16 years now. And then we sold that agency to WPP about 6 years ago. That agency became Mirum, which still exists under the Wunderman Thompson brand as a 3,000 person, 30 country agency. I left 2 years ago. And now I'm doing what I did while I was in the agency world, which is, you know, writing, podcasting, creating media and content. I now invest and advise, but I spend a bulk load of my time when we're not in a pandemic on the road speaking to audiences all over the world.
That
short
is,
story, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
It's hard to explain.
Well, that was the start is really important. The fact that you come from a retail background, and it's always interesting to me that you, when you have retailers talking to retailers, it's not somebody that just is, you know, new to it or just learned about it. You grew up in it. And that provides a very interesting perspective that not everybody has unless they grew up in retail.
And I think also the digital side, being there so early, having a PC or Atari computer in the 80s, when the idea of omnichannel even came out, and it still is prevalent in the retail space, my sort of agnostic approach to retail can be sometimes frightening. And I think it's why people like Artemis in the early days were eager to get me up on the stage to talk about it, because I never saw it as this, where does it line up in the world? It always frustrated me that things weren't, you'd buy something and then they'd say, oh, you bought it online, you can't return it to the store. Like that type of basic thing where I shopped your brand. Now it seems more commonplace. And I think that COVID-19 really pushed that idea forward for even the smallest of merchants and retailers. But that was also the other point of it, Bill, that I just never was afraid of digital. And I always saw it as an amazing new business opportunity for retailers versus this, how do we fit it into our existing matrix attitude? Which, again, I think COVID-19 washed away a lot of that.
You know, it was interesting. Artemis, I swear to God, I'm not going to dominate this conversation. You're far smarter.
Get in here, Artemis. Get in here.
Far more than me. But I just had this, you know, one observation. And I do remember I was in a meeting a number of years ago, and I asked the question about, you know, the online versus the in-store, the experience, what this particular retailer was doing, and whether they still use the phrase omnichannel, blah, blah, blah. And the way that it was explained to me was that they were just learning that they can't have merchandising for the online and merchandising for the in-store, that it needed to be seamless in one. And this was just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it was shocking to me that that would not be so obvious, that if you go online and you find the blue dress and you go in-store and you want to buy the blue dress, that they only have red dresses. That doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So it has come a long way in a short period of time.
For some of us, it's, you know, it's been the small bright spot in, you know, what so many of our members are and retailers are dealing with. So I wanted just to hear, Mitch, I know you're speaking about some of this at our show, at the big show in January, but what are you seeing? And with the huge spike we saw in e-com, you know, what is your perspective and what are you hearing from your clients and friends?
Well, this is a great moment. I mean, let's talk in specific with retail, because there's more macro issues that we can discuss in terms of the world and how we're all feeling. I believe that this moment created a level of forced innovation at the smallest of retailers' side that pushed up to the national multinational brands that make it impossible to go back to. While at the same time, I'm very hopeful because as we record this, we're still in the middle of this pandemic. It depends where you are geographically. And for sure, there's a massive difference, by the way, between what's happening in Canada and the US. That my hopes and prayers are that these retailers who have done a good level of forced innovation don't go backwards. Like when there are vaccines and people are traveling freely or people are just opening up way more, that they don't sort of shorten back all these new things that they injected into their retail experience. That would be the tragedy. So what are some of those things? Think about stores that didn't have free pickup or free delivery. Think about stores that realized we could do free pickup and free delivery and then add on a service where we're doing something with our consumers on Zoom. That could become a subscription model. They might have launched certain initiatives that were digital only that they didn't have before that they might recoil on. I'm worried when things get again, air quote, normal. I think about, you know, something that Artemis knows we've talked a lot about in the past, but even just local advertising. Think about how many national retailers really started leveraging local advertising because suddenly region by region were different. Some stores had different hours, some stores were open, some weren't. My favorite example of contactlessness, which is so low tech, but it's amazing, is a lot of the indie bookstores, what they did to allow people to browse the stores is they turned the books backwards. So they didn't have to pick them up. They could just read the summaries in the back as it sat on the shelf. So it doesn't take a lot of technology to even do contactlessness to create a better or more reasonable experience in the state of the world. So much to talk about in that space.
No, it's interesting because we ask a lot of our retail leaders, you know, about the innovations that came about during the pandemic and the speed at which they were able to bring these to the consumer, which was pretty extraordinary given the fact that they like to test and retest and refine and refine and test and refine. And then 2 years later, actually put something out where in this particular case, they had an application that they were looking at, a service, a concierge service. They had been thinking about it and they not only were able to do what they needed to do to create the app, they implemented it immediately nationwide.
And forced innovation,
yeah, with great response. And so I've asked a number of them, are we going back? Is this the new day as it relates to retail innovation where we're not going to test ourselves silly? We are going to go to the consumer because this is what the consumer wants. And if they don't want it, they're just going to reject it and we'll go back to the drawing board. But we just got to get it out there to see if it's going to work. And almost all of them said, we hope it does not. They won't commit that it won't, but they say, we hope it does not.
You know, there's a bigger concept here that I think retailers haven't understood, and I believe I've simplified it to a lesser degree. When you go to a physical store, you're not buying, you're shopping. Yes, there are people who know exactly where to park in the shopping mall and then make a beeline for the exact store and know where to stand and do all that stuff. But the vast majority of people like me, like Artemis, like you, Bill, we go to physical stores for an experience, to shop, to look around, to just be there. It's a social thing. It's a community thing. Online isn't like that. Online has traditionally been a buying channel. And where I think you have hit the hammer on the head, but I'll elevate it to a macro thought that retailers can really lament on is, and Apple is a great example of this, the Apple Store. They had to figure out how to actually make their physical stores more of a buying experience rather than a shopping experience. That indie bookstore had to figure out, how do we make this a better buying experience versus a shopping experience? Because we can't have people hanging around for too long and all that sort of stuff. Online, if you look at the better DTC, the direct-to-consumer brands and what they're doing, a lot of the innovation was around video and images and more experiential things, which is great because suddenly the DTC online brands were trying to figure out, how do we let people shop more, spend more time here, experience more things? And you saw them grabbing certain things from places like Amazon or Walmart, which is normal. But again, those were still more engines of buying. And that's the amazing thing we're going to see from the best retailers going forward, which were the ones or which are or will be the ones that at a physical level can bend the world and have it be a lot of shopping and buying? And then which are the ones in the online channel can create a better shopping, not just buying experience? So that differentiation between shopping and buying is probably the biggest chasm that you saw certain retailers really embrace and drive forward, like you gave some examples of. And I think the ones that are really struggling right now are the ones who aren't breathing that way. They're breathing like we have to have digital e-commerce and we have to keep these stores open. And there is that chasm that exists between the bigger thought of buying and shopping experiences.
Who do you think, you gave a couple examples on kind of favorite, you know, contact lists, and that shopping experience. So what do you think is doing it really well from a digital perspective and kind of that conversion factor and taking advantage of this e-commerce kind of growth that we're seeing?
It's really hard to not give a big shout out to our mutual friend, Kevin Ertel at Nike. It's really hard not to look at what happened in their last quarterly report in terms of both the numbers of how they were able to grow and sustain the digital business and make it that 70-80% range while they're shutting down their own stores, their third-party stores, their wholesalers. I mean, there was a lot of problems there. And Kevin and his team, and I know he's not alone there, were called upon by their executives to really drive this forward. And they put their foot on the gas pedal. And the results are demonstrating that philosophically, they're talking about understanding the value of digital in a very different way, which is they're seeing now that their ability to sell a product online at e-commerce has a better ROI for them than even wholesale. That's a staggering thing to think about. Now, if Nike is doing that, and again, you know, we live in weird times. This is weird times where people are suddenly buying a lot more Nike and leisure clothes than they are, you know, as we watch a Brooks Brothers, unfortunately, you know, collapse. It's strange to think that we live in a world where pharmaceuticals aren't selling as well because they're just doctors aren't writing scripts in a world where you can't get a pool because everyone's buying pools in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of what might be a massive, you know, recession. So the lesson also for me is in optically being able to recognize that had you said to me in March of 2019, it's going to be impossible to get a pool, you should invest in pool companies, I would have called you a fool. Right. And then had you said to me, you know, you should, you know, buy some pharma, let's put aside the three companies that currently have an active vaccine for COVID-19, but that they're going to have 30-40% drops because, you know, doctors aren't writing scripts, I would have thought that's not possible. I mean, we're all going to be home and on and on and on. So that's the challenge we face by giving an example like Nike, but also recognizing that it's a fool's errand to think we really knew what was going to happen or how this is going to play out even going forward.
And I love the Nike example because they're also, you know, just so global. Their footprint is big and they've started to see trends, you know, outside of the U.S. that you know, a lot of us can learn from.
So. There's also with that, Artemis, this sort of like what I call the no fault of your own. Like who would have thought that there's going to be a global pandemic? And then who would have thought we're all going to be working from home? And then who would have thought that because of that, suddenly we're spending more on leisure wear? And who would have thought that brands that we know and love, you know, I travel a lot, which I don't do now, but I think of brands like Tumi, you know, which Samsung bought, which I love. And then, you know, I'll get a 40, 50% off sale and I don't even click because in my brain, I'm like, where are we going? So it's a very strange thing to also look at success as a metric of sheer luck. It's very hard for us to accept, but a lot of the examples where we're seeing people be big winners is a lot of sheer luck.
There are a lot of the small guys too. I was talking to some independent retailers, and when they were forced to close, they were forced to innovate as well. I mean, they certainly don't have the depth of resources that the bigger guys have, but they all of a sudden realize I've got to now create a web presence that I have never had before. It's got to be better. It's got to be more robust. It's got to bring people in, bring them back. And I've got to figure out a way to get them what they want, where they want to get it, because I can't get them into my store. And there was a tremendous amount of innovation from the small guys as well. And I thought that was incredibly impressive. To your point, I mean, who'd have thunk? I mean, this story has never been written. There was no playbook. And they're writing it as they go along. And it was really interesting to me that the big guys, you know, you saw how they were responding, but you can't forget the Main Street guys, and they were responding as well. Innovation and being really creative.
Yeah, my favorite example of that would be Norman's Rare Guitars out of Tarzana, California, small strip mall, used vintage guitar retailer. And anybody who knows the music instrument business, like I do, knows that people were not buying guitars and basses and drums like we used to. Norman's Rare Guitars was one of those retailers where it became very niche, almost like buying art. Norm's a character. He's an interesting guy. He's in his mid-70s, maybe younger. I apologize to Norm Harris, if you're listening. I'm sorry, you're probably younger than that. But he was paying a lot of money to get people into that store, right? Kind of local advertising, newspapers, radio. His YouTube channel becomes a massive success. And suddenly he's making more money on YouTube than he ever spent on advertising. It's literally cash flow positive. He launches a guitar of the day every day at around 2 p.m. He sells that guitar, which would normally sit for months or years on his shelf somewhere in the world, built a global database. Pushing it further, he launched the All Guitar Network, completely separate business, but it's basically the Golf Channel for guitars, Netflix type model, and he's killing it. Now, the story isn't because he did this during COVID-19. He's been doing this for close to a decade, but he benefited from doing that work up front. So you're right, Bill, that there were many small merchants and independent merchants who sort of were very agile and figured out for survival and how did they sustain it during this period. But there were many, many small retailers that were tinkering with this that had maximum velocity. He's benefiting so much from the fact that not only is the market for these secondary used guitars exploding, but then suddenly everyone wants to pick up a guitar and people have that disposable income that are buying pools and they're buying more expensive or nicer. Like, again, so a lot of it is luck, but he had done a lot of preparation to be lucky. And this is a tiny store. And so you look at it in the ecosystem of not just retail, but music instruments, and you know, maybe one of the greatest retail stories that people don't know.
Those are the best stories, by the way.
For me too.
One thing I wanted to make sure we talked about today that our small retailers and large all kind of have in common is talking about culture for their organizations and productivity and balance for their employees right now. What are you hearing in the space, seeing the space? You've run your own organizations, sold them. I mean, what's on your mind as it relates to culture, and what can maybe some of our members kind of make sure they have their pulse on?
I'll answer this question if we agree that we're not going to finish on it, because I'll be the most pessimistic when it comes to culture and productivity right now. When the pandemic hit, let's call it mid-March, April, we saw this massive boost in productivity and everybody shifted online and we thought, this is so great. We're so good. We can do this without doing that and blah, 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 blah. I think we underestimated that a lot of people were fighting for their very survival. And then the second part of it is culture, which is, I just don't buy it. I mean, I've done this for a living. I've been virtual forever. I've had physical offices forever as well. I don't believe that anybody's building a culture right now. I have a friend who's got a daughter who just started working at Spotify and she's never been to the office. She's met a couple of her peers physically, socially distanced on a patio during the summer. We're heading into winter here in Canada. It gets cold up here. She's enjoying her job. Apparently she's doing very well. She has no attachment to this company or the culture. And if we're in a world that's going to bring, let's call it 25%, let's call it 30%, let's call it 50% of our time will be spent remote, I don't know. I'm sure people are listening to things he doesn't understand. We do this. We have day drinking on Zoom with our peers. But the vast majority of people who are interfacing with their current organization are probably interfacing with only a handful of those people on Zoom. They are missing everything from walking through the cafeteria to seeing other people talk, to seeing people in boardrooms, to hearing other people's problems and mistakes and errors and wins. And how many stories we heard in the retail space of promotions and programs being sent to a physical retailer and it never being unpackaged and brought to out front of the store and just sits in the back because they got busy. Someone else didn't do it. Someone else came in and took their shift. And this was a huge problem for retailers for decades, probably still is, that these promotions don't hit the physical floor because one person in one store just, you know, flaked on it. So I struggle with the idea of productivity and culture being A plus and able to be replicated in digital spaces. It's going to take a lot of work to get us there, if that's even possible. But I think we need each other. And that's why we need physical stores. That's why we need shopping malls. And that's why we need libraries and office spaces. I'm a massive proponent of it.
We need more Mitch Joels. I'm so tired of reading the brick and mortar's dead, stores dead, the malls are dead. I so object to that, and it is just so wrong.
But we're not seeing it. The minute a place opens up, we are seeing pent up demand. We're recording this as some In-N-Out burger opened somewhere in the Midwest. There are 12-hour lineups to get a double-double. I mean, people want to go. They want to experience. We had one of our first Uniqlos open up here and massive lineup for hours with social distance. So it's wrapping, six times longer around the block because we're maintaining our 6-foot rule up here. So I don't see that. If you look at areas like South Korea that opened up really early, there was like rage shopping. People couldn't wait to buy real high-end luxurious products. Yep. So I don't think our habits changed. There was a fundamental issue of retail in the States that's been there for a long time, which is there's a lot of retail square footage per population that always was. But I would always make the same argument. Please join me at Christmas time near Aventura Mall in Miami-Dade County. And you tell me why everybody every night is lining up 45 minutes in cars just to get in there. And it's because it's one of the only games in the area. And people love it, and it's a great experience. It's one of the best malls in America. We know that, but it's a full-on experience. So if it's dying, why is it so hard to get into?
Right. Well, I think the issue that we face is when things come back, we have a tremendous opportunity to tell a whole different story, a whole new story. And I wouldn't even say it's new. It's the right story to tell. And we're seeing the consumer has been extremely resilient through the pandemic. And we just today announced our holiday forecast with a year-over-year growth between 3.6 and 5.2%. And this is primarily based on where the consumer has been for the last 8 to 9 months. And you look at where it was last year, we're doing exponentially better than last year when we didn't have a pandemic. So there's a lot of reasons for that. But anybody, they're stressed, but they're not going away.
Well, we also have to recognize that the truth is we don't really know how it will play out. So the one area that I have a question mark over is consumer behavior. I think about elderly, so let's go 65-ish plus, not to offend anyone in the world.
Not yet.
Not yet. Same here. Their ability to build their customer database and shop digitally for food, with the exception of, let's call it, fruits and veg and meat and some baked goods, that's going to change basket behavior. It's one area. Next behavior, if we think about places like Walmart and Costco, I don't think people are going to stop going there. But if the economy does get, if Main Street becomes more of a reality, I don't think Wall Street's an indication of where the economy is really at. A lot of people who are furloughed, a lot of uncertainty, there's a lot of things happening in the world. So their basket won't go to zero, but it might drop significantly. The stuff that they would just sort of casually buy in the Costco, Walmart, they might not pick up. They might just be going for more essentials or might be spent buying less just to be safer. Right, we bought the pools because we didn't go away for vacation, but now suddenly we might not be employed and we got bills to pay. So I think there are certain areas that leave a question mark in my brain. Again, I'm sitting from a different perch. I'm up here in Canada. It's very, very different than the politicization of this virus down in the States, which again, everyone's got their perspective. I happen to have mine and I'm very strongly for it. But that doesn't change what I look at in terms of consumer behavior. So has the consumer behavior changed? Well, it takes 30 days to change a habit. It's been 8 months. So we see very different habits. So what you're seeing could be the echo of usual habits. I think we'll know more in a year's time at Christmas, whether or not we've got more of the rage shopping and pent-up demand, or a world where people have to be excessively cautious because we went a little too kooky and there are maybe too many handouts or too many options. That someone's going to have to pay for whom the bell tolls, right?
Yeah, you just want to stick around long enough to read those books. I think it's going to be fascinating.
I agree.
As the history of this time is written from all the different angles. Mitch, we are almost out of time, but before we go, we have a segment that we enjoy immensely, and it's called Rapid Fire.
One of our favorite segments on Retail Gets Real is Rapid Fire, thanks to our sponsor, PwC.
But we're just going to ask you a question and you're not going to think about it. You're just going to say the first thing that comes to mind.
Lots of swear words. Let's go. I'm just kidding.
Oh, you said you didn't swear.
I don't swear.
It's me you got to worry about. All right, Artemis, kick us off.
Last book you read or listened to?
Oh, I got to look over here. I just finished reading The Best American Short Stories 2020. It's great. By the way, all of those, any of the best American 2020 or whatever year it is, the short stories, essays, travel writing, science fiction, those companions, if you want to get smart fast, just read them all.
Awesome. What is Mitch Joel's favorite song of all time?
Yeah, I have to talk about someone who's been a music journalist for... Okay, I'll give you one that makes me love music more, which is a band called The Dawes, and it's called May All Your Favorite Band, All Your Favorite Bands. That's what the name of the song is.
All right.
Artemis? What holidays coming up? What is one thing, physical product on your holiday wish list? Say like a velour jumpsuit.
Yeah, I was going to say my trip to Florida, which isn't happening. Could that be on my real wish list? Because it's not happening. I would say that.
All right. So what is the app that Mitch Joel can't live without?
Pocket. It allows you to share. It allows you to save content from the web and access it anywhere. And with the tagging feature, it makes me look much smarter than I am.
Awesome. Artemis, close us out.
The last thing you geeked out about?
Oh, anything that you're kind of looking at. I'm big on all of this sort of streaming technology. Let's go with Elgato, and they have a product called the Stream Deck, or their key lights. Their lights are amazing too.
That's pretty awesome.
That's not a positive note. So.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
Hey, Mitch, if people want to learn more about Mitch Joel and what you're doing, where do they go?
Easiest thing is to Google Mitch Joel or just head to 6pixels.com.
That's awesome. Mitch, thank you so very much for your time. This has been incredibly fascinating. We're excited to have you here. We're excited to see you in January. And I'm very excited to get you back and sometime next year to kind of look back on where we were today, where we've gotten to, and where you think we're going to go next.
I'm happy to spend time with Artemis and you, Bill, anytime. And I'm a massive supporter of the NRF, as you probably guessed. And I hope that everybody listening to this really takes a second to appreciate when you have an association that's really got your back. I've seen a lot of industries that don't have that, and it's an important factor. So thank you for all the work that you are all doing over there.
Mitch, thank you for saying that. And thank you all for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. You can find more information about today's discussion and more at nrf.com. And please, send your feedback and episode ideas to podcast@nrf.com. As we say during this time of a pandemic, we close with please be safe, be well, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.